This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. American movies and American gangsters grew up together. In the 30s, audiences were riveted by fast-talking, tough guy Jimmy Cagney in The Public Enemy.
Oh, please, you ain't gonna slug me, are you?
Maybe not today, but I'm telling you this for the last time. When Dutch comes around, he's gonna leave you some beer, and you're gonna take it, and you're gonna kick him with the dough. If you don't, somebody's gonna drop by here and kick your teeth out one at a time. Get me?
Yeah, and you'll be needing some right away. How many shall we leave?
Oh, two kegs.
You hear that, Dutch? Bring in five kegs.
Hollywood's Hayes office insisted that gangsters never get away with their crimes and their loot, but as crime itself became more complicated, more organized, the movies changed with them.
Had a good trade, made a good living, police protected you, and there were courts of law. You didn't need a friend like me. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask for respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather.
And if you had any doubts about the gangster's stamina, remember that the Irish mob movie The Departed won the Oscar last year, and that the box office right now is dominated by Ridley Scott's blockbuster American Gangster.
And I got hundreds of parents of dead kids, addicts who OD'd on your product, and that's my story for the jury. That's how I make it all stick. This man murdered thousands of people, and he did it from a penthouse driving a Lincoln. Aside from that, you got nothing to worry about.
That's pretty good, but that's why we go to court, isn't it, Richie? Because I got witnesses, too. I got celebrities. I got sports figures. I got Harlem, Richie. I took care of Harlem, so Harlem's going to take care of me. You can believe that.
So what is it about gangster films we love so much? Is it the underdog story, the outlaw story, or is it the gangster himself? And is it possible to make these pictures without glamorizing the gunsels? Our number, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later, baseball GMs cry havoc and let slip the instant replays. But first, why we love gangster movies. We begin with our cinematic pal Murray Horwitz, director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center here in the Washington, D.C. area. He joins us today from the studios of member station WDAV in Davidson, North Carolina. Hey, Murray.
Hi, how are you, Neil?
I'm good. So what is it about gangsters that makes such great movies and that keep audiences coming back over and over again?
Well, just as you were playing those clips, it occurred to me that part of the reason is because some of them are just really terrific movies. I mean, really some of the greatest filmmakers ever to make films have made films in this genre. Certainly, a part in a gangster film is something that any actor would kill, you should forgive the expression, to do. So we've got some great actors saying these roles. So, I mean, always stick with the art. I mean, some of the greatest films are gangster films, and that's one of them. But it seems to me that the chord that they touch, and this is by no means original, I just hope it's accurate, is that it's the American dream. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of these really are what we used to call Horatio Alger stories. It's somebody who comes from modest circumstances or dire poverty and who works usually his way up through the system to excel and to be a person of respect. As you pointed out, after the Hayes office stepped in the 30s, that person sort of had to get his comeuppance by the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. But it really is the sort of flip side of the American dream.
Mm. Is it the urban equivalent of the Western?
Well, that's a great point that you make. Yeah. It's interesting that the gangster movie has thrived and has sort of transformed itself a number of times. You mentioned Goodfellas, and certainly the current American gangster owes something to the gangsta films of, like Boys in the Hood and Juice and some of the other urban...
I guess even going back to Cotton Comes to Harlem.
Right. Absolutely so. The sort of conventional gangster films with African Americans have been somewhat fewer and further between, although there was an interesting film that Bill Duke made in 1997 called Hoodlum with Lawrence Fishburne and Vanessa Williams and Andy Garcia. But I think that the truth of the matter is that the Western, which we think of as the American pastoral, mm-hmm. hasn't really survived as America has transformed itself from a rural to a very urban society. The gangster movie keeps its credibility and its contemporaneity.
Well, to help us understand our fascination with hitmen, drug dealers, and pimps, let's turn to John McCarty. He's the author of Bullets Over Hollywood, the American gangster picture from The Silence to The Sopranos. And today he joins us from the studios of WGY in Albany, New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
And what is it about the gangster, do you think, that makes him or her such an attractive cinematic character? And again, going back to the other part of the question, is it possible to make these pictures about despicable people without glamorizing them?
Well, I think you've already covered the answer to the first part of the question. It really does buy into the fantasy of power, and the more difficult times are, the more successful gangster films seem to be because they really reflect that kind of wish fulfillment. I mean, everybody just kind of loves the idea of being Tony Soprano and getting the best seat in the restaurant instead of being shut out because you don't have a coat on or something like that. It's that part of it. As far as the glamorization, I think one of the most interesting things is that when Mario Puzo's novel The Godfather was published, it was reviewed very, very favorably as having put a human face on the gangster. Very authentic and that sort of thing. And yet when the film came out and the film did exactly the same thing, it was criticized in many quarters for glamorizing the gangster. And I think that's just the nature of the medium.
Transition from the printed page to the silver screen.
Yes, and the gangster is being played by actors and popular leading men, charismatic people. Jimmy Cagney was very charismatic. No question about it, he was a violent psychopath in his films, in the gangster films. But because of the charisma that Cagney had, which was innate in him as a performer, one could say, or one did say in many cases, that he was glamorizing that type of character just by acting him.
Yeah, Murray Horowitz, you go back to a character, Cody Jarrett, in White Heat. Jimmy Cagney, a little bit older than you might suspect, but he's clearly playing a psychopath. He's playing somebody who's absolutely a nutter, yet that scene at the end where he goes, I made it, Ma, top of the world.
Right.
It's one of the great scenes ever.
I was going to say top of the world to you too, Neil, but it really is one of the great scenes. And I think that that we really identified something or put our hands on something, because if there is anything like redemption, or if this is anything that really doesn't glamorize the contemporary gangster picture, it is at a certain point our really feeling, you know, these guys are really twisted. These are some really strange, crazy people. I think of Warren Beatty's maybe the greatest performance by an actor portraying manic depressive illness ever in Bugsy, where you see this guy is really crazy. And then, in a way, maybe a contemporary correspondent of James Cagney is Joe Pesci, who is winning and cute and teddy bear and very funny and lovable. But in some of these movies, like Casino and Goodfellas, he's nuts. He's a psychopathic, just terrible, just awful.
Let's get callers involved in this conversation. Our guests, Murray Horowitz and John McCarty, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's go to, who is this? Nina. Nina's with us from Cooperstown in New York.
Hi. I wanted to, as an Italian-American, just go into what I think attracts me and my little cousins. And I think it's the power. It's the power and the money that's portrayed. And I think it gets to the truth of, you know, corruption being in all aspects of industry and how, you know, it's really truth and whatever industry, whether it's politicians and bribery scandals or the police and kickbacks or, you know, hospital physicians and the unnecessary tests that go on. I think it all comes down to power and money.
John McCarty, do you think there's validity to that theory that these are all subversive looks at the underside of America, not just the bad guys, but in the way that element of corruption that underlies, too much of modern life?
Yes, I think so. I think a sub-theme of the gangster picture could probably be called, the capitalistic dream run amok.
The capitalistic dream run amok.
That's a better way of saying what I meant when I said the flip side of the American dream. And the other thing, and John, you mentioned it first, was this idea, and our caller brings up, this idea of audience identification. Wouldn't it be great to have that kind of money and that kind of power? I think in any sort of film genre that where people exist in extremes or in extremis and outside of the bubble in which we usually live our lives, prison movies are another example, we somehow tend to identify and say, gee, what would I do under that circumstance? You know, which character would I be like? Mm-hmm. And I think it allows us the freedom, the movie-going experience for the couple hours we're in the theater for a gangster movie allows us that kind of guilty pleasure of, you know, how we would act under those circumstances. Hmm.
And yet it also, at the very end, has a moral to it in the sense that you could say all of these movies are, you know, they follow the rags to riches to ruin. And so that we're sitting there and we're identifying with these characters and saying, what would we do and wouldn't it be great? But then we are put, at the end of the film, we're put, back on our feet again and well grounded by the result of what happens to these characters in most cases. And the American Gangster, the latest, is certainly a case in point. That's the entire film. It literally is rags to riches to ruin.
Go ahead, Murray. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask John, because he's seen the movie and I haven't, but Frank Lucas is the character that Denzel Washington plays, right? And mm-hmm. somebody just told me today that what they don't do in the movie is they show him emerging from prison at the end, having, you know, paid his debt to society. But what they don't mention is that Frank Lucas went back to drug dealing and went back to prison. So there's a certain, maybe they are glamorizing a little bit. I don't know.
Well, he didn't do it as successfully as he had the first time. So you can't go rags to riches to ruin to mediocrity.
Yes. And oblivion.
Right.
And to consultancy.
Right.
We're talking with John McCarty, author of Bullets Over Hollywood, the American gangster picture From the Silence to the Sopranos, and with Murray Horowitz, director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We're also going to be talking, coming up, about the risk of glamorizing gangsters and BET's gritty version of the American Gangster. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, our fascination is with gangster movies. What is it about these pictures that we love so much? Is it the underdog story, the outlaw story, or is it the gangster himself? And is it possible to make these pictures without glamorizing the criminals? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can weigh in at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Our movie pal Murray Horowitz is here. He's director and COO of American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center in Maryland. John McCarty also with us. He wrote the book Bullets Over Hollywood, the American gangster picture From the Silence to the Sopranos. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Ron. Ron with us from Detroit in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
I agree with your guest, Mr. McCarty, when he says it's a lot about identifying with the corruption, but I would go a step further and say that it's not just the corruption in our society and police forces and in organized crime and in large corporations. I think the whole dynamic of stab your coworker in the back, get what you want at all costs is epidemic in just about every environment where there's something to get. And I think that we enjoy these movies because we can breathe a kind of sigh of vicarious relief sitting there watching all these guys doing this sort of stuff in the movie that we do on some level every day in the environments in which we have to survive. I think it's a really dog-eat-dog world out there, and I think it reflects what we all kind of have to go through.
John McCarty, I wonder if you wanted to expand on your earlier remarks.
I'm depressed now.
You are.
Yes.
See, I'd always thought of the corporate Carol, the day-to-day, work-a-day world situation. That was analogous, not to gangster pictures. Those are prison movies.
Well, I think he's probably talking around Enron and things like that. You could make a gangster picture about the Enron situation.
You could.
In fact, it's probably somebody asked me the other day about where I thought the gangster film was headed, and I said I think corporate crime is where the next, we're going to start seeing more and more films about that. The larger picture, and that's what I was talking about before when I said I think that a sub-theme of a lot of these movies is the capitalistic dream run amok. And you take for example that the great scene in Little Caesar, one of the the earliest, and that is when Edward G. Robinson meets the Chicago gang boss Diamond Pete Montana, and the guy is called Diamond Pete because he wears a diamond stick pin, and Edward G. Robinson looks at that stick pin and he eyes it like he's looking at a beautiful woman. The next thing you know, there's a fade and he's got that stick pin on and Diamond Pete is, sleeping with the fishes. And that in a nutshell is a lot of what we're talking about here. And that reflects, there's no question about it, the gangster film reflects, I think that one of the reasons that the Western is no longer with us in any kind of way, although certain Westerns, Westerns continue to be made, but I often say that, they're more about past Westerns than our Western past. Hmm. Whereas I think that the gangster picture has really taken over, and that the gangster picture really is America's story told in modern terms.
Hmm.
Can I add one more quick comment?
Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I see it on all levels and in all ages, too. I mean, a lot of the teens that get into the whole gangster attitude, it's just as powerful a draw for teens as it is for people in their 20s and 30s and 40s. If you looked at The Sopranos, what kind of an audience they drew? They drew an audience probably that ranged from the mid-teens all the way up through people in their 60s and 70s. I'm certain about that.
Thanks very much, Ron. That's interesting. And Murray, I wanted to ask you, we mentioned at the beginning that movies and gangsters grew up together, and there was a lot of, back and forth. I think it was Raymond Chandler in his essay, The Simple Art of Murder, the great crime novelist, of course. And he wrote that after a while, the real-life criminals started watching these movies and picking up patter from the films, and all of a sudden nobody had a revolver anymore. They were all packing heat.
Right. I think that's right. By the way, I think whatever definition you have of the gangster movie, I realized just going over my notes this morning that one of the things I'd left out was automatic weapons. I mean, it's sort of de rigueur. But I think that's very true, Neil. I think that, who might again say Raymond Chandler? I think that it's absolutely borne out by what's happening today. And as the hour progresses and we talk more about BET and about gangsta life in America, I think that the movies have informed the sense of style of a lot of young people in America and old people as well.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, even though I'd never want to work wherever Ron, our caller, was working, the truth of the matter is I think it even extends to the family. We're often told by sociologists and criminologists that the gang or gang life is a substitute for family, but there's generally a real father figure or real parental control, and it exists in opposition to normal society. One friend of mine said that she knew somebody who said, watched The Godfather and said, gee, I wish I lived in a family like that. They're all so close and they communicate so well. So, I mean, that's part of, I think, John, what you're talking about with the universality almost of the gangster picture, it's very inclusive. And by the way, we haven't mentioned much, Neil, about other cultures. You know, you've got Chinese movies like Hard Boiled, and you've got from Japan the Yakuza movies, and you mentioned The Departed. We were showing at our theater not long ago Eastern Promises, the David Cronenberg film about Russian gangsters in London, and now, African-American movies. So there's something that is striking a chord among a whole pile of people.
And which French New Wave cinema picture was Gérard Depardieu standing in front of a movie picture of Humphrey Bogart with a Gauloise out of the corner of his mouth saying, Bogey.
Right.
Yeah, that was.
I'm trying to think of
Belmondo.
Jean-Paul Belmondo, perhaps.
And
yes.
Breathless.
Breathless.
Yeah, well,
there you go.
The gangster phenomenon. I mean, the genre travels well because every country in the world has its problem. Every non-communist country in the world has its problems with gangsterism.
Here's an email we got from Michael in Portland, Oregon. I grew up in a very small town in Iowa, and the older residents spoke almost with pride of the occasional sighting of Al Capone's motorcade coming through town. I think it was that sense of one man against authority that made it delicious. On the other hand, my favorite gangster movie has always been the one that casts the gangster as the true villain, Key Largo. Again, Edward G. Robinson is the bad guy in that one. Of course, Bogart was in that picture, too, so he had to be the good guy. But that idea of one man against authority, I think you've been talking a lot about that, John McCarty.
Well, that is true, and that's the essence of, I think that's one of the appeals of the Western, certainly, when it was on, when it was in its heyday, and that has continued into the gangster picture. We all identify with that particular figure, just as in real life, nobody really wanted to get robbed by John Dillinger and his gang, but everybody kind of, it's kind of cool what he's doing, you know, and Bonnie
right,
and Clyde.
This Robin Hood thing.
The Robin Hood, yes. Rob from the rich and keep it all, but not give to the poor, but still at all. That's with us in real life as well as, you know, reflecting in the what we like in our entertainment, particularly
gangster
films.
And you have to remember, of course, John Dillinger shot to death by the FBI as he walked out of a gangster movie in Chicago.
Yes, that's right.
Manhattan melodrama, right?
He loved movies, in fact, and gangster movies particularly, which is all very common among gangsters.
Yeah, is there any truth, John? I ran across one story. There's a very early Ruben Mamoulian picture called City Streets from 1931 that apparently Al Capone adored.
That could very well be. That's with Gary Cooper and Sylvia Sidney, I think. But that could very well be. I mean, they all did. I mean, we did a documentary on based on my book, Bullets Over Hollywood, and one of the interviewees was Henry Hill. I mean, this guy never misses The Sopranos, and he absolutely, I mean, you know, it's like whenever there's a screening of Goodfellas, you can imagine, he's right there.
Yeah.
So, and they will all say that. They will all say that. That's one of the real truisms of watching The Sopranos, where they all walk around and they talk about, they don't even say Godfather 1 and 2, they say 1 and 2. Because they, but they keep pulling me back in two, right. You know, that kind of thing. And
everybody knew it wasn't Star Wars because we could never keep those straight.
Right.
Absolutely.
Three
Absolutely.
Was seven, one was six.
Yeah, well,
you know,
anyway.
There's a quote I'd like to paraphrase a long time. I think George Raff was once interviewed, and they asked him, why do so many gangsters, real life gangsters, sound like you? And he said, because I taught them how to talk. That's what he means. The movies taught them how to talk.
The movies taught the mob how to talk.
How to dress. Yeah. And Cagney, for example, and Robinson, because they both grew up in the Lower East Side of New York, they modeled their characters on a lot of the gangsters that they saw, and in turn, some of the gangsters growing up started modeling themselves on Cagney and Robinson. So there's a tremendous two-way mirror going on here.
Let's get another caller in. This is Debbie. Debbie with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi, Debbie. Go ahead, please.
I was wondering if your guest could comment on the cross-cultural, if there is one, nature of this kind of glorification of violence. I understand what most of the people have been saying about how Americans identify with the persons that are committing the violence, and they see it as powerful. And I know that other films in other countries portray violence, but I'm questioning whether or not they portray it with the same kind of glamour that American movies do.
Murray, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so, in a lot of ways. You mentioned some of the French New Wave stuff, Neil, like, you know, Bob Le Flambeur and The Red Circle. Certainly, I would say that the Asian movies that I've seen, not to lump so many cultures together, but in general, the Chinese, the Hong Kong, and the Japanese gangster pictures I've seen do show lifestyles of the rich and powerful. I mean, it's something, it's very glitzy. It's something to be.
Well, in Japan, it comes from the samurai tradition, too, another set of outsiders.
Right. Yeah, I don't know enough to say. I know the Yakuza also go back a long way, and I don't know exactly what the role in society is. But generally, there's a lifestyle that one would aspire to. Those French New Wave pictures, there's something incredibly hip and cool about them, but nothing glamorous, I think. You know, these guys don't live. It's more as in Goodfellas, which is based on Nicholas Pileggi's book, Wise Guy. And part of the reason for the book, I think, was to show how hard these guys work. He was following these petty mobsters around from like 8 in the morning to 12 at night. And he said, why don't you guys just get a job? You know, it would be a lot easier. And I don't think that the gang life is as glamorous as it is portrayed in movies, but I think that glamour does exist in movies from all kinds of cultures.
John McCarty will give you the last word on this.
Well, I think that's true, but to the woman's point about the glamorization of the violence, in some cases you think about films by John Woo, Hard Boiled, the gangster films, and The Killer. I mean, there is a real glorification of violence because the whole thing is really about, you know, the sensuousness of the ballet, of the slaughter and things like that. Right. I wouldn't say that a lot of American gangster pictures are really like that. And quite frankly, one of the most interesting aspects of that is that, to quote Bugsy Siegel, you know, we only kill each other. It's not like they're out slaughtering civilians. In most cases.
Most of the time, yeah. That's before they invented the drive-by. You know, anyway.
Yes. Well, that's a contemporary thing. Well, no, that's a contemporary thing.
We'll get to that. Debbie, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank our guests, John McCarty, author of Bullets Over Hollywood, the American gangster picture from The Silence to The Sopranos, with us today from WGY in Albany, New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And Murray Horowitz, our pal, with us today from WDAV in North Carolina. And Murray, you're heading back home soon?
Heading back home tomorrow, Neil, and we didn't even mention Some Like It Hot, my favorite gangster movie.
It's not a gangster movie, it's a comedy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Not every movie or TV show glorifies gangsters. BET, Black Entertainment Television, is airing a series titled American Gangsters. It chronicles the lives of some of Black America's most notorious crime figures.
The killers all belong to the Nation of Islam's Temple 12 in Philadelphia. And they are all members of a shadowy criminal syndicate that few have heard of outside of Philly, the Black Mafia.
Each week, the BET series gives an unsentimental, real-world view of the life of a different gangster. P. Frank Williams is producer of the American Gangster series with us now from his office in Los Angeles, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
How's it going with you today?
It's good. And I assume the title of the show, and it's meant to sort of serve as a companion piece to the fictional film American Gangster.
No, I don't think it was a companion piece. We kind of had our own separate show going, and that movie, which was obviously in production, finally got going. So just kind of ironic. Right.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So it obviously has resonance, though. And what are you trying to accomplish by profiling these very successful criminals?
Well, I mean, I think for BET is that, you know, we show a lot of music videos and we show a lot of kind of talent and stuff like that. But we wanted to show the flip side of some of the negative parts of what happens in these communities when the drug lords and the famous guys from all of our hoods and their ride and what happens in kind of the aftermath of that. So this is a real world look at some of the most notorious crime figures across the country in a documentary style, not a Hollywood movie kind of way.
No, I understand. But nevertheless, you're also telling a story with voiceover announcers and portentous music.
Oh, for sure. I mean, but it's obviously has to be entertaining. But we want to put something on it that's boring. So we give you all of the stuff they did, that the girls, the cars, you know, some of the violence and all of the stuff that people want to see. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that people know that 9 times out of 10, most people are selling drugs. As you can see from Frank Lucas in the movie and the doc that we did last week, it doesn't end up in a good place. You end up in jail or you end up in, you know, getting shot at. Or in the case of the episode that airs tomorrow, Felix Mitchell, he died. He was only 32 years old. So, you know, the dope game is kind of unforgiving, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yet some people would find a certain glamour in that, certainly find glamour in access to drugs and sex and automatic weapons, as Murray Horowitz was talking about earlier. How do you even tell the real story of who these people were without letting them get up on their soapbox and say, hey, this was a terrific life?
Well, you know, one of the things about the show is that we offer that balance. I mean, as much as you get Frank Lucas talking about all of the great things he did, or even Nicky Barnes or his cars and or him posing on the New York Times, you go to those places where the people were addicted to drugs, where families were torn apart. I mean, I went into an apartment building in Oakland, California, where, you know, basically a whole neighborhood had been decimated, you know what I mean, and mm-hmm. and whole families. So we go, this is a documentary style where we really go in depth. It's not just about the glamour. And we see, you know, we have the police and the FBI and some of the family members. If you look at, there's an episode about Tookie Williams in which we showed a guy who got beat up, you know, frequently by Tookie Williams. And he offered no remorse, you know, whereas Tookie was celebrated as this great American gangster and, you know, started the Crips. He beat up and did a lot of really negative things. So we want to make sure we show that this is a cautionary tale, you know what I'm saying?
And I wonder, were there any decisions that you had to make to ensure that these tales remained cautionary?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, you know, you don't want to glamorize certain things, so you have to have an amazing amount of balance. I know that in the edit I did on Felix Mitchell, I made sure that I took out some of the people who, because as much as the government or even some other people look at these people as negative in their hoods, they were kind of like the Robin Hoods. They gave out turkeys. They did stuff and amazing things. So we want to make sure that we also show that. So I don't want to just put in a whole bunch of people celebrating somebody. You know what I mean? So we wanted to have a balance. And I think that's for BET. That's what we really aim to do. That at the end of the day is teach our viewer that, you know, if you're out there and you're in this world or you're doing this kind of lifestyle, it's usually not going to end up in a positive way. It might be good for 15 minutes or a year or two, but it won't be too good, you know?
Thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Hey, we appreciate it, man. You have a great day. And check out the episode tomorrow, 10 o'clock on BET and www.bet.com.
P. Frank Williams, producer of BET's series American Gangster, with us today from Los Angeles. More about gangsters and glamour on the big screen in a moment. Michael Eric Tyson joins us next. Plus, will the instant replay come to Major League Baseball? I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. But let's wrap up our conversation now about our fascination with gangster movies. Joining us is Michael Eric Tyson, professor of theology and African-American studies at Georgetown University, author most recently of Know What I Mean? Reflections on Hip-Hop, today with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Good to have you on the program, Michael.
Always good to be here, Brother Neil.
We've been talking about America's love with the gangster film, in particular on this weekend where American Gangster is dominating the box office, and got a lot of calls from people who love gangster movies. Aren't these movies, as they're told from the protagonist's point of view, inevitably glorifying that figure, the criminal?
Well, to a certain degree, absolutely. Some would argue in the case of an African-American criminal, however, that ironically enough, there hasn't been a democratization of the acknowledgement and glorification of the black gangster and criminal. So that in one sense, when one sees a Frank Lucas with all of the brouhaha occasioned by the departure today, or at least the acknowledgement that he would depart of Dick Parsons at the top of Time Warner,
right,
and recently Mr. O'Neill, the reality is that Frank Lucas could have well been a CEO had he gone in a different direction, had opportunity presented itself to him to be able to use that ingenious mind of his for more edifying purposes. As it stands, the acknowledgement that he had assets in excess of $250 million in the mid-70s ranks him certainly near the top of any criminal gangster in this country. And ironically enough, you both have to acknowledge that overlooked reality while at the same time giving the cautionary tale about how that life will inevitably end.
Difficult thing to do when a man is simultaneously portraying himself as Robin Hood and as, well, you know, any ogre you want.
Sure.
As a drug dealer, he's wiping out entire neighborhoods.
Well, he's decimating entire neighborhoods. He's making more vulnerable the people who consume the product, the Blue Magic or whatever other, you know, acronym, a name can be attached to the heroin and the like. So, yeah, it's the duality there. On the one hand, he is an absolute heartless criminal who is vicious even to his own family. On the other hand, he created pockets of at least episodic wealth for those who consumed, the benefits of his product, and he tore them up and built them up at the same time. It's a rather ironic judgment about this singularly interesting and intriguing figure.
I wonder what you make. One of our earlier guests noted that you can have the same portrayal in a book on the printed page, put it up on the screen, and you will see something different.
Of course, because the visual is rather more arresting. We live in a post-literate culture to a large degree, so that the cinematic literacy that is evoked by films is much more arresting and goes to the heart of the matter, gets to the cinematic jugular, so to speak. So, yeah, when you put it up there on the screen, the nuance, the complexity, the back and forth, the moral trajectory is lost. But at the same time, you gain a kind of pictorial display of the different stages through which a person can endure or transform if it's done well. Look at Tony Soprano. I mean, here was a guy who was a monster from the very beginning,
mm-hmm,
but there was moral, workings around that monsterhood, so to speak, or The Godfather. So now with Frank Lucas, you know, there's a back and forth that at least is occasioned by our conversations and many others that talk about he was both good and bad at the same time. He did some good, a lot of bad, and yet in the annals of criminality in American society, the black gangster and godfather serves even a useful function. For instance, in the film itself, you know, there was disbelief that a black man could somehow best the mafia. That's a story that has to be told, even as the overarching moral viewpoint of gangster gangsterism itself has to be critiqued.
Yet a story that's been told before. It wasn't Cotton Comes to Harlem, but was the other film that followed on about the numbers game in Harlem, started by African Americans and resisted attempts to take it over by the mob.
Sure. Well, you've had many films. You had Hoodlum. This was originally the article that Mark Jacobson's article that this film was based on. It's called The Return of Superfly. You had Superfly. You had The Mac. But I think in terms of a crossover film, this film did better even among white Americans than African Americans. A large percentage of females were involved. So this was a transcendent figure. In one sense, Frank Lucas becomes the Martin Luther King Jr. of the crime element in American culture, ironically enough, with all apologies to Dr. King, but as a transcendent figure who moves beyond the ghettoization of black crime into now potentially the annals of American crime.
Is it appropriate, and we're talking about somebody as careful with his character as Denzel Washington and a movie maker as careful as Ridley Scott, both of whom said they were intensely concerned that they did not want to come off glamorizing a terrible drug dealer, and yet it seems, in a way, they both have.
Yeah, well, you know, the glamour and the glory are inevitable. People find themselves rooting against the character played by Russell Crowe, Richie Roberts, mm-hmm. and rooting for Frank Lucas, in part because criminals are a relief valve when they're cast in that Robin Hood mode, especially in oppressed and minority communities, because they speak back to the unjust power that prevails even among the police. What we can't escape here is that the real criminals also are the police people, the white police people who ruled over African-American communities, not simply by their illegal trade in drugs and complicity in the very drug trade that Frank Lucas was brought down upon, but also because of their racist beliefs. So in one sense, the compensatory value of a Frank Lucas is that he is, in a sense, getting back at the white supremacy that rules even in the crime world.
Mm. Michael Eric Dyson, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend.
Michael Eric Dyson, a professor at Georgetown University teaching theology and African American studies, author of the book Know What I Mean? Reflections on Hip Hop. Today he talked to us from his office here in Washington, D.C. And coming up, what a lot of people would consider a crime, instant replay in baseball.